morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The first item this morning is going to be House Bill 307. We're just going to have a brief hearing on that. Joining me today are Senator, my co-chairman, Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, and Senator Regan. On each member's desk, you should have a copy of the House Bill 307, new spreadsheets provided by Ledge Finance. And at this time, I'd like to recognize my staff, Tim Grusendorf, to explain the changes. We've already had a public hearing on the Senate version of this bill, but there have been some changes to the legislation as it arrives from the other body. With that, it's my intent today to have the changes presented to the Finance Committee and set it aside for further consideration later on this week. With that, Mr. Grusendorf.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. Before you should have a worksheet prepared by Legislative Finance and the new House bill that has been sent to us by the House. Just so everyone understands, the co-chairs, their staff, Ledge Finance, and the administration all sat down together to discuss to put forward a fast-track supplemental, which this is being considered as. We reviewed all the items, and we, if someone had something going on with one of the items, we would discuss a little bit. We basically just tried to put together the items that were truly fast-track issues or things that I guess we can kind of call no-brainers, something that we had to, that no one had any concerns with and we were going to put forward. So what we did is we reviewed the whole list put forward by the governor. We had a few items that we removed. We removed all the capital projects, and we've done this in the past. So this isn't anything that we haven't done before. All the capital projects were removed and were going to take place. They were going to be done in the regular capital project, capital budget. We have included four capital projects back in, and they were, two of them were at the request of the governor, and the other ones were related on timeliness and funding. The first capital budget was for education, the major maintenance for the Bethel campus water and sewer line repairs. The second one was the Cordova Hospital roof repair and replacement. They had a lot of snow up there, so that was rose to the fast track level of needing to be done sooner. The Anchorage Chugiak Fire Hall replacement and the Inter Island Ferry Authority. Those were the four items that were added back into this budget. Two of them, like I say, were put forward by the governor, and they were in his 13 capital budget, and we put them into the 012 fast track, and then the two other ones. Of the items in the operating budget that we chose to remove and to vet a little bit further, this doesn't mean that they will not make it into the supplemental at the end of the day. The slow track can be done in one of the appropriation bills later. The four big items that we were discussing was first in the Department of Commerce, corporation business licensing. It's $3.4 million. The second one is in education, student and school achievement, $1 million. The third one was labor, AvTech, for $250,000. And the last one was the Department of Law, and that has to do with the university's ORP settlement for $20 million. And all these items we just needed to look into a little more closely and vet a little bit better, but none of these items are excluded and can't be addressed in the supplement that will happen in one of the other appropriation bills. So those are the major changes. I guess the funding for this supplemental, there's $57 million in UGF, $1.2 million in designated general funds, $6.4 million other funds, and $7.1 million in federal funds, and for a total of $71,969,800. And this total is $36 million less than the governor had proposed, but all these items have been approved, and the administration supports this version of the fast track.
Thank you, Mr. Gusendorf. Are there any questions? And we do have the OMB Director Karen Rayfield here to answer any specific questions that individuals may have. I'd like to note that Senator McGuire has joined us some time ago. If not, we will set this bill aside, and it's the intent to bring this bill up later on this week to be dispatched by this committee. With that, we'll stand in recess while we change over to get into the meat of this morning's business. We're in recess.
To bring the committee back to order, we're now going to take up Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Tax, Oil and Gas Production Tax. This Senate Bill 92 is being sent to us from the Senate Resource Committee, and we're going to start our process. This is the first hearing on this bill. There will be multiple hearings on this bill for the next several weeks. Today, the intent is to have Senator Pascavan, co-chair of Senate Resources, introduce the bill. Tomorrow, we're going to have the Department of Revenue. They will testify on the resource version of the bill. Thursday, PFC Energy, and for those of you that are home, is a consultant service that is working for legislative budget and audit, which is a legislative committee that handles and manages our consultants. So PFC Energy will be here to offer their view on the bill. And this will be the first of many presentations from PFC Energy. Then on Friday, and we'll have invited testimony from the industry. We're still working on the schedule. Next week, we will have industry come in. We're trying to get three major oil-producing corporations in the state, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, all here on the same day to make more continuity because of the complexity and the many facets of what we're dealing with. I'm also working on the schedule for potential public hearing on this bill. We'll most likely have at least two different time frames for a public hearing. The intent is to have a public hearing on this CS coming from, or the resource version of the bill that's before us, the committee, and then over a period of multiple days, we'll be working with PFC Energy, having presentations and discussions and the complexities and the different facets of where our tax structure may be challenged or where maybe we have some strong areas. And then after we have that work done, which will take multiple meetings, the intent is to have another CS from the Finance Committee. And then once we get that far along, we'll have another round of testimony. We need to have the stakeholders have the opportunity to come in and talk about the bill as it is then here in several weeks, and also the public, and then also give them the opportunity for the committee to modify that, and then hopefully we'll be able to take a bill on through the process. So that's kind of a high level overview of what's coming. Again, there's going to be multiple hearings. The subject matter is complex. We're going to try to, after we have the initial introduction here the next three, 4 days, the intent is to then compartmentize the sections of the bill, the areas of concern. If we're dealing with progressivity, if we're going to talk about credits, we're going to talk about information, whatever, it's different subject matters, and then try to get the detailed concentration on that particular item, and then we'll go to the other one, and then at the end put the mosaic kind of together to try to help the public follow along with the process here, also those of us at the committee, to make sure we have time to read the information, fully understand the subject matter that's in front of us, so we can make an informed decision for the state. So that's kind of the layout. It will be flexible, because we're dealing with multiple companies, and they all have different day jobs that they have to take care of, and we need input at the committee. So we'll be juggling the schedule, but we pretty much are going to be laying out a schedule for the oil work done at the Finance Committee every morning, every day, 5 days a week, until we're done. There may be some gaps if people start getting tired, or the information, we need more time to read and digest it, or we're having trouble, you know, having time frames to get presentations put together. Other than that, it's going to be more straightforward, because we still have our other committee work to do. So you'll see the committee scheduled both morning and afternoon. The intent is to leave the afternoons more open to the normal committee business of capital budgets, operating budgets, legislation. But clearly this is a primary focus as far as an individual piece of legislation that we're dealing with outside of our mandatory budget requirements. So there will be some items that get pushed back in time that individuals in at the committee and or our colleagues feel is very important to them or their district, but we're going to concentrate mostly on this broader statewide policy issues, make sure we cover them, and then we'll try to take care of the smaller issues along the way. So with that, kind of giving everybody the lay of the land of what we're going to do, I'd like to go ahead and ask Senator Pascvan to come forward, please. I've asked him to present the bill. I gave him what I thought would be 2 hours, but he's got an hour and 45 minutes. We'll probably take a break at about 10 after, a five-minute break. I want to give the presenter a little bit of time to rest up a little bit or what have you, and then give us the opportunity then to stand up and stretch a little bit. We have at everybody's desk or chair a binder put together by the Resources Committee that has the resources work and presentations in it, which will serve as a reference point. Of this will be the first of probably at least two binders you're going to have, and maybe more by the time we're done with this process. So with that, Senator Pascvan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Pascvan, and I am the senator from Fairbanks, and with me today is Mr. Jeff Stepp, my chief of staff, and he has helped prepare the slide presentation and put together the binder so that the substantive materials, if any committee member has any questions regarding the source documents themselves, he can direct any committee member to the source documents. So, but thank you, Mr. Chair, for having us here today. Beginning with the presentation, as kind of an introduction, we will go through the concepts of Alaska as the owner state, provide a summary of the Department of Revenue reports dealing with ACEs over the last several years, some of the lessons that we have learned in the Senate Resources Committee, trying to focus back on some basic petroleum economics so that the individuals on this committee may have some of the substantive knowledge applicable to the oil and gas industry. I had asked at the Senate Resources Committee level to have the Department of Revenue define the problem. So they presented a slide which was faxed to begin the conversation. So we've included that in here, and a discussion will follow that to address some of the issues that the Department of Revenue has raised, essentially defining the problem. And then we will get to the meat of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 as far as the topics that are raised in there, the rationale for including those components in Senate Bill 192, and then finally concluding with what I believe is an appropriate conclusion, which there is much to be optimistic about as far as Alaska's future. So I think that the concluding remarks will be filled with optimism. Again, turning to slide number three, it is important to begin the concept that owner state issue where Alaska, different from many other jurisdictions in the United States, starts this process as an owner state. And the publication that is identified on page 3 is a book that through you, Mr. Chair, I was made aware of, and I thank you for that. This is a very informative book, but I think that in its preface, this beginning statement is an important point to begin the discussion, knowing that the returns for good decision making are so high, but that the punishments for bad decisions can be so cruel. And that is why it is important to make sure that substantively, rather than emotionally, that the determinations are made as to the oil taxation issue. On slide 4, it identifies the central objective in designing any fiscal regime, and it indicates that while it is easily stated that the enduring controversy is how you establish a fair share of the wealth accruing from the extraction of the resource to the taxing jurisdiction, at the same time encouraging the investors will continue to invest in your hydrocarbon resource. And again, from a ownership standpoint, Alaska has to consider both its receipt of oil revenues both as a royalty share and as a production taxing interest owner. So we have two major points of approaching this issue of how to design a fiscal structure. On page 5, we turn to another publication called Fiscal Systems for Hydrocarbons, and in chapter 5, it addresses designing an efficient fiscal system. And one of the key points here is that while it is certain that both the oil industry and the host government itself share the common objective in generating high levels of revenue from their industry, that the host government and industry are not aligned as to all issues. And so that is where the, so to speak, the friction comes, is in the areas where there is not full alignment between the oil industry and government, where host government's aim is to maximize the revenue and the net receipts to the Treasury. The goal of industry is to maximize their rate of return on investment, and those are some of the, it identifies some of the issues that are considerations where we distinguish between the goals where we are aligned with industry and some of the goals where industry and government may not be aligned. So I think that is a good starting point, again, to understand the design of any fiscal system that may come to be in the state of Alaska. Again, on slide 6, is still in that same publication, it is the goal of industry to ensure that the return on capital is consistent with the risk associated with that project, and that is their overarching goal, and it's, again, a very primary goal for them. The next slide is, I think, an important understanding to know that at the time of the formation of our Constitution more than 50 years ago, it was understood by the people at the convention that Alaska was and was going to remain a resource-rich state with the potential for interest coming to this state for purposes of extracting our resources. And we know that Bob Bartlett's portrait and bust are placed on the second floor of this very building that we are in to, so to speak, recognize the importance of his role in the development of Alaska's Constitution, and certainly his role in developing and identifying the issues that are important for policymakers to consider when addressing the creation of a fiscal regime. And Bob Bartlett's presentation as part of the Constitutional Convention identifies, you know, that we do as a state have vast resource potential and many interests wanting to develop those resources. He then identifies that we must not be confused with the concept of development and exploitation, and it is incumbent upon the policymakers of the state to make sure that the financial welfare of the future generations, as well as the present well-being of its citizens now, are to be the primary factors in developing that fiscal system. And then I think what is absolutely critical is the identification of the two real dangers that were identified at the time of the Constitutional Convention. And the first danger is exploitation under the thin disguise of development. And he identifies that as the extraction of the resources from the state of Alaska without leaving a reasonable return to the state itself. And in identifying that very first real danger, I think Bob Bartlett was focusing upon, again, that balance between the state and an industry as to what is a fair return to Alaska as an owner state as compared to what is a fair return for industry who is making the investment in the jurisdiction. The second danger that was identified is the concern of the lack of development of the resources of the state. And what Bob Bartlett identified there was the recognition that multinational interests can stifle development in a jurisdiction such as Alaska by acquiring land or acquiring rights to those resources and then determining not to develop them because it would compete with their other interests in other parts of the planet. And again, in that very last paragraph on slide 7, where he identifies the interest, quote, will attempt to acquire great areas of Alaska's public lands in order not to develop them. And I think that that is an important danger that one has to consider when one recognizes, for example, in the area of leasing, when one provides exclusive rights to vast tracts of land, is to whether those vast tracts of land are acquired not for purposes of exploration, development, and production, but acquired for purposes of making sure that they don't compete with their other interests elsewhere in the world. So I think that in following the philosophy of Bob Bartlett from more than 50 years ago at the Constitutional Convention, as policymakers, one should be ever vigilant as to these two dangers in drafting any fiscal tax system. Getting into the next area, leaving the area of Alaska as an owner state, but into the summary of the Department of Revenue reports, we turn at slide 9 to the Department of Revenue presentation of January 14th, 2010. And this is included as extracts from a letter from the Department of Revenue Commissioner Galvin at that time to Governor Parnell. And it goes through the question as to whether ACES was working. And so here we are just a little more than a year ago where the Department of Revenue Commissioner was indicating that the question was whether ACES was meeting its intended goals. And at the same time, as far as revenue generation, while at the same time encouraging investment. And the January 14th, well, it's 2 years ago. Thank you very much. It was 2 years ago. So the question was at that time whether ACES successfully allowed Alaska to share in high oil prices. while accommodating for the fluctuation in pricing. And the conclusion of the Department of Revenue was very clear that ACES did adjust when prices went up and did adjust also when the prices tumbled. And it identifies in that middle paragraph that it kept the oil operations in Alaska highly profitable relative to other oil provinces that they may be operating within. And then that last bullet point there indicates that since ACES passed the legislature, overall spending had increased. And it's, again, part of the report to the legislature on the operation of ACES in January 2010. Continuing in slide 10, I believe that this is also a critical point to consider, that oil taxes is not the only factor that one must consider when designing a fiscal system, that the while it is an important factor, as Commissioner Galvin indicated, it would be misleading to isolate the influence of other key factors, and he identifies in there world oil prices, geologic potential, access to land, the resources and markets themselves, cost of infrastructure, support services, and other related activities. So I believe it's important to understand taxes, while as an important factor in designing an overall fiscal system, that these other factors must be considered as well. The on slide 11, the ACES structure and tax rate are addressed, and what I believe is important to identify in this slide, there's been much discussion over the many months as to terms such as effective tax rate, nominal tax rate, and marginal tax rates. And Commissioner Galvin in this report is identifying that these issues will come before policymakers. He identifies that each of those terms is subject to certain limitations, and that for policymakers to be aware of the differences between effective, nominal, and marginal tax rate discussions. And in that bottom paragraph, it identifies that when the term marginal tax rate is used, as he appropriately indicates, it is a rate theoretically applied where it shows that each dollar they invest is subsidized by the government based upon the amount of the marginal tax rate, and that they avoid paying for their investment. And again, where he's the last two sentences, a marginal tax rate of up to 87% initially sounds excessive. However, at that same price level, the effective tax rate is less than 40%. The marginal rate of 87% actually represents the state's portion of any new investment made at such high oil prices. And again, this is the Department of Revenue's Commissioner's report to Governor Parnell. The conclusion is set forth at page 15 of that January 2010 report, where overall the Commissioner reports that ACES is performing as expected. In other words, what the legislature intended in 2007, the Commissioner reports it is performing. The revenue levels are at the anticipated levels, and the investment incentives appear to distribute the tax burden in the fashion that encourages reinvestment. So while the commissioner at that time identified the challenges for implementation of that tax regime that was created in 2007, the overall conclusion that the Commissioner of Revenue presented to the governor was that ACES is performing as expected. With respect to the challenges, certainly this committee knows from the good work that it did 1 year ago in providing the, I think, $36 or $37 million for that information implementation system, you know, it's to address those challenges that the commissioner was identifying. We now turn on slide 13 to the production tax status report that the Department of Revenue submitted to the legislature 1 year ago on January 18th, 2011. And these bullet points are created from the executive summary that appear at pages 1 and 2 of that January 2011 presentation. With respect to industry investment, it is identified that capital expenditures have increased in each of the four fiscal years since implementation. With respect to the impact on exploration, development, and production, it's identified that exploration has generally increased after 2003. It does identify that even with that increase in exploration, that production has continued to decline. And in this report of January 2011, in the last bullet point, it discusses industry employment and new entrants, meaning new operators in the North Slope region, that with respect to the employment numbers have continued to rise steadily from 2006 through 2009. We know that those numbers through 2010 and 2011, and we understand also going now into 2012, that employment numbers are very strong on the Central North Slope. And also identifying in that last component or last sentence of that last bullet point that the number of companies filing annual tax returns doubled between 2006 and 2009. And the reason why I believe the Department of Revenue Commissioner identified that is in relationship to the passes of either the PPT or the ACEs, that it seems to have attracted new operators or new entrants into the Central North Slope region of the state of Alaska. Again, continuing in the January 2011 executive summary, it identifies the topic of credits, which is an issue of much importance to the fiscal system. Credits, so to speak, give back or provide an incentive to those that make investments in Alaska. And it is identified in this executive summary that the amount of credits has increased annually since 2006. One of the issues that will be, I am sure, before this finance committee are the capital expenditure estimations going forward, 2012, 2013, 2014, which we did see within the Senate Resources Committee, which identify, I believe, a very strong potential for the continued use of tax credits based upon investment in our Central North Slope. Again, identifying in that middle bullet point on slide 14, it talks about the complications that arose when Alaska's fiscal system transitioned from a gross tax structure to a net tax structure, and the complications in the administration of a tax system that that arises out of that. It identifies as of January 2011 that the first audits under the net profits tax have been completed, and that was a an audit of the component of a year which had partially the gross tax system and the net tax under PPT. Still working again on the first ACES tax audit as a full ACES year. Again, it identifies in 2011, as it did in 2010, that it's hampered in its tax reporting by the lack of a centralized database. But again, that is what this Finance Committee addressed a year ago as part of the capital budget process. The conclusion of January 2011 indicates that drawing any conclusion about the effect on Alaska's investment climate is difficult. And they made it clear that, you know, production did continue to decline, but and that it was important to for Alaska to consider its competitiveness. But all in all, getting through the report, the commissioner said that it was difficult to draw any conclusion one way or another about ACES. Continuing into slide 15 is the government's fiscal regime is one element. Again, we identified in one of the theoretical publications in the first section of this presentation that identified the other elements such as resource risk, political risk, environmental factors, the availability of a trained labor force and equipment, you know, that all of those factors must be analyzed when designing a fiscal system. The middle paragraph there, I believe, is extremely important to understand when we sit here in 2012 addressing a tax structure that was put into place in 2007. The middle paragraph identifies, so to speak, the calamity that was experienced in the United States and the world in the year 2008 with the dramatic upswing in prices, where it identifies oil prices as high as $134 a barrel and then as low as $38 a barrel just 6 months later as part of the Great Recession in the United States and the recession that was experienced worldwide. And that whole process is stifling investment worldwide, slowing down business activity, again, making it very complex to analyze whether a fiscal tax regime is effective or not effective when you have such dramatic changes in the world's economic system. I think as a conclusion that I would offer as to both the 2010 and 2011 reports, either directly to Governor Parnell or directly to the legislature, is that the reports do not anywhere explicitly say that ACES is broken. They identify that that there are issues that need to be looked at, but there is no identification of ACES as being broken. So that report was as of January 18, 2011. The next slide is presented for purposes of on the very day that we received the report from the Department of Revenue as to the status of ACES was in the other body. HB 110 was rolled out on January 18, 2011, and then Senate Bill 49, the companion bill on the Senate side, on January 19th was rolled out for the first time. So just so that this committee understands the timing of the reports from the Department of Revenue with rolling out a bill seeking dramatic changes in the ACES tax structure. Specifically now transitioning from a summary of those Department of Revenue reports to some of the specific lessons that were learned at the Senate Finance or Resources Committee. And we on slide 18, I believe that it's important to understand some of the internal issues that are confronting state government and state policymakers that arrive or derive out of issues that exist in the Department of Revenue that were identified both in the January 2010 report to the governor and the January 2011 report to the legislature are explicitly referenced in this October 2010 Fast Enterprises study. And this study of the Department of Revenue was an external study essentially requested by the Department of Revenue to address the complications that that the Department of Revenue was having. And the Fast Enterprise Report study focuses on this patchwork of 17 automated systems, over 100 manual side systems trying to administer the 22 tax programs. And in that middle bullet point, they talk about this eclectic mix of homegrown side systems with unsecured, unstable spreadsheets spread well beyond their intended use, and that these 17 systems were used to administer different taxes, and they were put together without any integration or overall architecture. The systems don't scale, they're inflexible, and they're difficult to maintain. It continues in the next slide. identifying the problem of why here we are in 2012 without any essential audits of the ACEs, even the first year of ACEs application in the state of Alaska, that because of this complication in the Department of Revenue, that they are spending their time doing things other than actually auditing, examining, analyzing, forecasting, and managing the tax system. And particularly in a later slide, we will focus upon the issue of the forecasting component, where the FAST study identifies that the Department of Revenue doesn't have much time to actually forecast because of some of the issues that they have with their internal operations because of their information system. Again, in the middle bullet point, some of the complications of this is that it does impose a burden on the taxpayers, which are the people paying the taxes, because the reporting processes are inefficient and ineffective. And as one taxpayer stated in this FAST Enterprise study, that the tax division's inefficiency makes interaction with the tax department by the taxpayer inefficient. And then what I believe is, so to speak, a important summary or an important takeaway point in this last bullet point, the when policymakers, whether it is the governor, whether it is the legislature, it indicates that the Department of Revenue cannot easily produce reports required by the legislature and policymakers because the current systems prevent timely, complete, and correct extraction of data, indicating that, quote, reports can be inaccurate and misleading due to incorrect and incomplete data and human error. Now, we hope to correct those problems moving forward. Again, I want to end this report on a positive, optimistic future. But again, what we are currently operating in is a system where one must approach this with a high level of skepticism because of this October 2010 indicates that we should not unthinkingly rely upon the reports as there may be incorrect and incomplete and include human error. Just a couple of weeks ago on slide 20, there was an audit of the that was conducted, and again the audit date is February 28, 2011, and the recommendation is that the Department of Revenue's commissioner should ensure staff within its tax division implements controls to improve the auditing in this area of oil and gas severance taxes, and that the legislative's auditor's current position was that there were significant control deficiencies that continued over the auditing over severance taxes that as to the FY10 fiscal year, and they identified the loss of experienced audit staff during the FY10 year, and it compounded the struggles within the section that the section was already experiencing. And again, I believe that those are, and to the credit, I think, of the Department of Revenue, that these are problems that the Department of Revenue has identified to policymakers and which have been addressed. But again, these are all very consistent, very cogent statements as to some of the complications that exist within the Department of Revenue as to oil severance tax issues. And then finally, on the bottom of that page is a conclusion that was reached in the Judge Gleason decision, and this is following the trial de novo, and the conclusion that was reached was, quote, the department's production forecasts and reserve estimates are unreliable. And I believe that if the only source of information was the court's conclusion as to that, and you didn't have the history, it would be more subject to question or more subject to criticism. But given the history of both the internal statements of the Department of Revenue, the FAST Enterprises conclusions as to the internal problems of the Department of Revenue, and the audit of the Department of Revenue, I believe that there is a sound factual basis to support the conclusion of the court that the department's production forecasts and reserve estimates are unreliable. And again, a conclusion should cause policymakers to consider whether information received from the Department of Revenue is fundamentally valid. I would, as an aside, indicate that within that decision is also, with respect to confidential information, that the conclusion was reached that the Department of Revenue's system was broken and headed in the wrong direction. So I think as a policy making body of in the legislature, this committee may well want to be aware of that to address those issues. Turning now to more of, again, of the, on page 21, how does one design a fiscal tax system to provide a balanced approach so that both the state and the industry have a belief that it is fair and it applies over a spectrum of pricing? One of the publications that was addressed in the Senate Resources Committee is this 2011 publication on U.S. energy tax policy, and Chapter 9 of that publication addresses the role of severance tax and credits for drilling expenses. And in the introduction to this publication, it talks about the complications that taxing jurisdictions are having in the current recession. And again, this is going back to a 2008 quotation that deals with the state of Alaska, and it identifies that Alaska has increased its severance tax on the value of oil production and attempted to stimulate future production by allowing a credit against this tax for expenditures on capital items. And again, that's the philosophy, is with the ACES tax structure, the credits were designed to stimulate production. We heard testimony by Dr. Gerking. He is the second author identified on page 21 of this publication, and Dr. Gerking's presentations, I believe, are important. In there, some of the questions that in designing a fiscal tax system, questions that legitimately need to be addressed are, do the state taxes tilt the time path of energy production to the present or to the future? And taxes can manipulate that production process in a way that may be detrimental to the state. So one must be aware of whether you're tilting production to the present or tilting production to the future. The other or another question that must be addressed is, do the upstream subsidies for exploration and development work together with the downstream taxes on production, again, to influence the levels and time paths of production and tax collection? And what are the implications overall of these taxes for the long-term sustainable use of a non-renewable natural resource such as the oil industry is on the Central North Slope? On slide 23, and again, this is from this, I believe, Chapter 9 of the role of severance tax and credits for drilling expenses, key finding is identified that oil production levels are closely linked to the size of the reserve base and that the oil production is relatively insensitive to to changes in oil price. And then tracking the experience of the U.S. oil industry over the last 50 years, the conclusion of this report was that severance tax has little effect on production levels. So from a theoretical application, studying the oil industry over the entire United States, the question is whether if you cut severance taxes, will that have a dramatic effect on production levels? Dr. Gerkings and the other authors in this publication indicate the conclusion that the severance tax has little effect on production levels. Turning to key finding number two on page 24, in the simulations, they suggest that the drilling expense credit may cost more than the incremental severance tax revenue obtained, and that the question then arises, well, why, if you provide credits, why, and if ultimately they don't provide more revenue to the state, why would a taxing jurisdiction want to provide credits? And one of the issues that they raise is that the credits may be worthwhile concessions if the state's objective is to generate increasing the severance tax rate. So in other words, as part of that balancing process, you can provide for a greater severance tax rate, and you provide credits to incentivize certain components of the fiscal tax regime, but one should not expect to see increases in production relative to the granting of those credits. Turning now on slide 25, and this is additional research that was derived at the Senate Resources Committee level, and the title of this document, and it's a publication from 2003, the title is Effectiveness of Severance Tax Incentives in the U.S. Oil Industry. And the conclusion that is reached here is that their results show that the severance tax rates cuts substantially reduce the state tax revenues collected, but yield moderate to little change in oil drilling and production activity. And I think poignantly stated is that this 2003 study as to the effectiveness of severance tax incentives indicates that policymakers should be wary of arguments asserting that large swings in oil field activity can be obtained from changes in severance tax rates. Again, I think that that is an appropriate guiding consideration, is that we should be wary of the arguments that large swings will directly follow changes in severance tax rates. Continuing here, that's and I think that this quote is probably as self-explanatory as any, quote, results of this study suggest that oil production is highly inelastic with respect to changes in production taxes. I think that's about as self-explanatory as one can be. Transitioning away from a discussion of the effects of production tax rates and credits as a component of an overall fiscal regime, and again, what we're focusing now are on lessons learned at the Senate Finance, or excuse me, the Senate Resources Committee level. We transition now in slide 27 to address the issue of gas and water handling constraints. And one of the many comments that I have heard is, you know, why can't we just poke another hole in the ground and get more well? And if it was only so simple, so it is important to understand the concept of gas and water handling constraints and their effect on production levels from the Central North Slope. To identify what this is, there are facilities called treatment facilities, and these are part of the above ground field infrastructures that make up the kind of part of the total oil field operation. And these treatment facilities treat the mixture that comes out of the ground of oil, water, and gas. And the function of this slide is to address why the issue of treatment facilities needs to be understood when one addresses the issue of production throughput out of the Central North Slope, which reaches the TAPS pipeline delivery system. And this is a presentation where it is a quote from Mr. Dudley Platt, said that facilities expansion of these treatment facilities may be needed. And he identifies that the large treatment facilities are maxed out on how much gas they can handle, and that they're getting close, again, this is in 2007, to being maxed out on how much water they can handle. And he indicates, quote, if they don't expect expand their facilities to handle these constraints, oil production will continue to go down. The next slide, 28, is a study that was done in May of 2004, and it was part of a presentation to the Senate Resources Committee that was very informative, and the title of that study is North Slope of Alaska Facility Sharing Study, and it was prepared for the Division of Oil and Gas, Alaska Department of Natural Resources, by a business in Anchorage called Petrotechnical Resources Alaska. And the presentation, again, approximately a month ago at Senate Resources, was very informative on this issue of facility constraints. And the topic here, or the discussion here, is that the North Slope processing facilities have specific design capacity limits, and those do limit the amount of oil, water, and gas which can be handled by the facility. And which is the important point here now in the second sentence. If the handling capacity of one of these streams is reached for a given facility, it limits the overall production output from that facility. While some facilities may be producing below capacity for oil, they are often limited due to capacity constraints on total water production or gas production. And as a just as an aside to that, Prudhoe Bay is primarily a gas-constrained field where, and we'll get into that later, where as you go further west, there are more water constraints. But again, when one discusses varying fields and varying treatment facilities, there are constraints whether that are reached with respect to gas and or water at those treatment facilities. In slide 29, continuing to handle the issue of the treatment facilities and their role in declining throughput, and kind of addressing the question that I have asked many is, well, why did the decline start in 1989? And we have a publication in 1989 from the Revenue Sources Book prepared by the Alaska Department of Revenue, where you know, it discusses that, you know, the vast majority of the throughput in the TAP system continues to come and will continue to come from the, quote, now declining Prudhoe Bay field. The decline in Prudhoe Bay is expected to be much more rapid than assumed in our spring forecast. It reflects a more serious gas handling constraint. The amount of gas which must be reinjected has increased substantially. And they conclude with the gas handling constraint will limit the ability to keep average annual oil production from falling. And then they address the issue of GHX-1, which was one of the first major treatment facilities that was constructed and completed in, I believe, 1990. And then there was also a GHX-2, which was constructed and completed in 1995. It identifies in that last sentence with respect to GHX-1 that once in place, the ability to reinject up to 5.1 BCF of gas production will slow the rate of decline in oil production. With GHX-2, they increased that capacity from 5.1 BCF a day to approximately 7.5 BCF a day during the winter months with colder temperatures, which is more favorable to gas operations. They can reinject up to about 8.1 BCF a day during the winter months as compared to the summer months. Continuing now in on slide 30 is a 1990 presentation as part of the Society of Petroleum Engineers. And this is a article written as part of BP exploration presentation. The title of the document is Production Optimization for Western Prudhoe Bay Field, Alaska. Again, it's a presentation in 1990 where it talks about for almost a decade, the Prudhoe Bay Field on the North Slope has produced at a yearly average offtake of 1.5 million barrels per day. But as the reservoir depletes and field gas-oil ratios, which GOR and W, GOR is gas-oil ratios, WR is water-oil ratios, and but they indicate the gas handling constraints make it difficult to achieve oil target rates. Again, as part of the facility constraints, you have the increasing gas-oil ratios, and as those increasing gas-oil ratios enter the treatment facility, it becomes increasingly difficult to meet the oil production rates. 1993 article as to development history and future potential of the Prudhoe Bay field, written by a gentleman or two gentlemen, one from BP and one from ARCO, again as part of a Society of Petroleum Engineers presentation at Anchorage, Alaska in May of 1993, where it identifies that Prudhoe Bay is seen as a mature field on an inevitable and irreversible decline, and that the field's oil production capacity dropped below that 1.1 million barrels in 1988, officially signaling the start of the decline, and that the onset of the decline was a direct result of limited gas handling capacity. And I think it's extremely critical to understand, as opposed to limited oil production capacity. In other words, the oil oil reserves are there, and the oil, in other words, it's not like the oil resources are not there, but that the gas handling capacity of the above ground field facilities are limiting that oil production capacity.
We're going to have a 5 minute, we're at recess time anyway. We're going to have a 4 to 5 minute at ease, and then we'll come back in and pick it up again. We're at ease. Come back on the record. We're going to continue here with Senate Bill 192, which is a presentation by Senator Pascavan, co-chair of the Resources Committee. He's going to pick up on slide 32, I think.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and so that the committee understands why I am focusing on these treatment facility constraints, is that over the many months, the focus on throughput has been an important piece of information that the Alaskan public has received, and I believe it's critical to go back and understand the history of declining throughput on the central north slope and connect that to these engineering issues and connect that with the above ground field facilities, so that that the understanding is very clear of what the relationship from between these engineering issues are with respect to those treatment facilities and throughput, so that there can be a better perspective. But again, now into slide 32, you know, for me, this is a very important slide. It arises out of an article that was written in 1998, again, part of a presentation of the Society of Petroleum Engineers at their annual technical conference in Louisiana. And the title of the document is Prudhoe Bay Field Facility Consolidations Pave the Way for an Economic Future. And this is co-authored by members from both, or from BP, ARCO, and Exxon. And they discuss the history of the Prudhoe Bay field on Alaska's North Slope, its production at that time for 21 years, talking about the gas and water production rates are at historic highs, but oil production has declined to less than one half of the peak rate that was achieved in the 1980s. They talk about the significant excess oil treatment capacity exists, but with water and gas handling capacity constraining the current oil production rates. And then again, what is in the next sentence or two, it talks about the owners of the Prudhoe Bay unit developed a major facility consolidation plan in 1997, and this immediately follows the construction in 1995 of GHX2, which was the last major treatment facility constructed on the Central North Slope. But now they developed this major facility consolidation plan in 1997. and they're addressing the issue of the excess oil treating capacity while preserving existing gas and water handling capacity. And the reconfigured facilities are expected to provide sufficient capacity at a lower cost to accommodate projected oil, water, and gas production rates over the remaining life of the Prudhoe Bay field. In other words, they're going to stay at that level of the treatment facilities, and that is consistent with a 1993 document where, when they were in the design phases of GHX2, where the conclusion was reached, and the exact or precise word that's used is unwarranted. It was unwarranted to construct additional major treatment facilities on the central north slope. The question for committee members is, has or does the conduct in the years from 1998 to now remain consistent with that plan that was put in place in 1997? And again, this is, you know, there's no emotion to this. This is just a business decision, and it appears that this is a business decision that's announced in this 1998 presentation to the Society of Petroleum Engineers, arising out of their major facility consolidation plan in 1997 that addresses harvest mode on the central north slope area. Continuing in slide 32, this is again a presentation, continuation of the same BP, ARCO, and Exxon article, where they address the issue of the oil production rates are projected to continue to decline for 2000 and beyond. The Prudhoe Bay unit working interest owners recognize the need to reduce the lifting costs commensurate with the decline in oil production. Again, they are wanting to reduce costs, which is a typical or standard manner in a mature field in addressing the economics of that maturing field. We now move forward to a presentation by two authors from Stanford University who wrote this article in conjunction with an author from BP USA, and this was a presentation on optimizing production from a mature field. This is a 2002 article directly identifying that oil production in Prudhoe and Kuparuk is constrained by the gas handling limits of the surface facilities. We then go to a 2003 oil and gas report, which was for the period December 31, 2002. This was Tom Irwin was a commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, and Mark Myers was the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And the discussion or the point that is advanced in this 2003 article is that, from the beginning of the Prudhoe Bay production, dissolved gas and water were separated from the crude oil and injected back into the reservoir. Over time, the reservoir's proportion of both water and gas to oil increased. Eventually, oil production was constrained by the rate at which the separating plants could process gas and water. Mr. Stepp has, if Mr. Chair, if he could.
My name is Jeff Stepp, staff to Senator Pascman, for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add one thing, and that's in one of the key points to the first article featured on this page, optimization of production mature fields, is that the authors are talking about ways to reduce costs and, as it says, optimize the production. They're not talking about increasing production from a mature field. And if you read the article, and it's not in your packet, but I'd be happy to provide it, it was compelling, I think, to the senator and to me that the assumption from the engineers is that decline occurs in a mature field after it peaks, and increasing production isn't an option, but trying to make the field more efficient is.
Go ahead and continue.
Slide 35, this arises out of, as the chair knows, I've been interested in this issue for more than a year now, and I've had a number of questions that I've advanced both to the Department of Revenue and to the Department of Natural Resources. And explicitly regarding the issue of these treatment facilities and constraints on throughput, I addressed a number of questions. These are two of the questions. Does the Department of Natural Resources agree that oil throughput at Prudhoe Bay is constrained by the ability of field operators to process and reject the associated natural gas? And again, the answer was explicitly yes. And also, there's information that as to the second point, as of the early 1990s, does the Department of Natural Resources agree that Prudhoe Bay was past the point where well drilling could stave off a falling oil rate? In other words, many members of the public believe that all you have to do is drill more wells and you can have more oil production. So the question is, well, what happened back in the late 1980s that addresses the oil production throughput rates that we're currently at? And the answer, one, is yes, we're past the point where well drilling can stave off a falling oil rate, but it's important to understand that the working interest owners in the late 80s, from that period of time, 1986 to 1992, engaged in a very aggressive well drilling program right at that point when the decline started. In other words, it peaked at that point, plateaued a little bit, and then began to fall. So from an engineering standpoint, they engaged in a very aggressive drilling campaign, and additional well drilling cannot stave off that falling oil rate. Turning now to one of the issues that was addressed at the Senate Resource Committee was the Judge Gleason decision and its information that was included in there as to life of taps. We have provided to each of the committee members the Brenna PowerPoint, and certainly I do not intend on going through that PowerPoint presentation, but I believe that the members would find that presentation very useful, and we've also included in there the Judge Gleason decision. I think that is also something that is informative and substantive, and that would be of use to the committee members as they draft together a fiscal structure to guide the state of Alaska. As far as the big market structure, what's important to take away is the information received from Mr. Brennan and Mr. Richards that the big three have a market dominance in the central North Slope to the extent that it is not a free market. And they address in there, and it's in the PowerPoint presentation, the aspect of the integrated nature of their operations, where they're combining the upstream production with the midstream transportation. And again, the question that is raised is, what does an integrated operation do to independents and others who would like to do business in Alaska? You know, fortunately, since the passes of PPT and ACEs, we've seen an increase in independents. We've seen an increase in other majors. Does an integrated operation do to the potential for new players to come into the Central North Slope? There are identified in the Brenna PowerPoint presentation those barriers to entries, which are also called pinch points, and you can find those at Brenna's slide 11 through 28. And he talks in there about the pinch points and access to treatment facilities, pinch points at transportation and the pipeline and tankers. And with respect to the treatment facilities themselves, the question is if a new player comes into Alaska, discovers an oil field that can produce 20,000 barrels a day, what can they do? And this is where the understanding of the above-ground treatment facilities becomes important, because if the above-ground treatment facilities are owned and the volumes that can enter those treatment facilities are controlled by a very few operators, so the only way that a new operator can access those treatment facilities is to pay money to one of the controllers of that treatment facilities to and enter into a facility sharing agreement, or something that's also called a back out agreement, where you pay for the other, for the owner to back out their volumes so that the new owner can inject their volumes. But again, these are potential barriers or pinch points to access. On page 21, there's a comparison to North Dakota, and why, when you always hear, why can't Alaska be just like North Dakota when it comes to some of the issues there, page 21 of the Brenna presentation is important. Turning to the pipeline transportation tariff, the example that was issued that if you have a $1 excessive tariff, and if you were the holder of a 100 million barrel field, that $1 excessive tariff reduces the economics to the holder of that 100 million barrel field by $100 million. In other words, the price of their crude is reduced by that $1, so they lose $100 million for because of any excessive tariff. There is a 1977 memorandum that was presented at the Senate Resources Committee, which addressed exactly that topic, where the discussion was, is, so to speak, does oil industry play the Alaska fiscal system by increasing our tariff costs, which then reduces directly the production tax rates that would be paid to the state of Alaska. And so that issue of that BP memorandum talks about the tariff manipulation issue directly. Again, I think rather than we'll just move on from there, when one talks about market structure and market dominance, which shows up at each one of the pinch points in Alaska. Mr. Stepp has...
thank you. Again, this is Jeff Stepp, staff to Senator Pascman. On the same point of market structure, we also received a document and talked about this in the Senate Resources Committee that was prepared for Governor Murkowski in the year 2003, because when the governor was elected, he established a goal of increasing production 3% per year. At the time, Mark Myers was the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and he prepared a white paper called Meeting the Governor's Goal, Increasing Oil and Gas Production by 3% per year. And in this memo, Director Myers identified the problem with the market structure on the North Slope and wrote, quote, "Mergers and market concentration on the North Slope have created a non-competitive environment in which three majors have a near monopoly that gives them a large competitive advantage in exploration, development, production, and transportation. It is this uneven playing field that has raised the barrier to new entrants, from smaller independents through large integrated majors. As long as these majors invested sufficient capital for exploration and development, the state accepted the consequences of the oligopoly. Since the existing majors no longer are willing to invest sufficient resources on exploration or development, the state must look elsewhere. The state must look beyond the existing majors to the new wave of independence and remaining majors. The situation parallels the experience in other oil and gas basins worldwide, several of which have successfully made the transition," end quote. And I just want to offer that as support of the evaluation by Brenna that he provided to the Resources Committee. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Turning now to slide 38, which again it addresses the issue of life of taps. One of the unanimous pieces of information that we received at the Senate Resources Committee was that as a field matures and under Alaska field analysis is the concept of a hyperbolic curve. And all of the witnesses that presented indicate that the Alaska North Slope basins are experiencing a, under standard decline curve analysis, a hyperbolic curve decline, and indicating that at the late stages or the mature stages in a hyperbolic curve, standard decline curve analysis, that we enter into a flattening out period, and we are at this time beginning entry into that period where the production throughput will flatten out for many, many years to come. But with respect to the life of taps itself, again, if one looks at Brenna's PowerPoint page 39, it's important to look at the value of the reserves and with approach this problem with the concept that the value now is greater than ever before. And even at the point in time when we were first pumping that first barrel in the late 1970s, the value is greater now. And that at $100 a barrel, at on the 7 billion barrels of proven reserves, that the resource on the Central North Slope with just the proven reserves is $700 billion. And the statement was very clearly made that it's a fiction to assert or argue that TAPS is subject to an imminent shutdown, that this is absolutely a false crisis. Now, the question then arises, well, what are the proven reserves? And under the statutory...
Just for clarity, imminent shutdown, we're not talking about mechanical problems. This is the amount of oil sitting in the basin yet to come down the pipeline.
Absolutely.
So we could have a mechanical issue.
Oh, yeah.
So just for the public to don't misinterpret what's being said. Go ahead and continue.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. That is an important distinction, and I appreciate your making that. You know, with respect to the proven reserves, what Judge Gleason had to do is she had to make a finding because it was statutorily required to provide what or to determine what the estimated life of those proven reserves are that are technically, economically, and legally deliverable into the TAP system. And the decision is a very conservative decision in that it is based only on the conventional oil resources that are established, in other words, proven as required by the statute. And what's also important to identify is what is not included within that 7 to 8 barrels of proven reserves, what is not included in there in the Central North Slope is the conventional oil that is not yet discovered. It does not include the heavy, which we know is 20-plus billion barrels. It does not include shale, which we know to be billions of barrels. It does not include ANWR. It does not include NPRA. It does not include OCS, either Beaufort or Chukchi, and it does not include Point Thompson. So the judge's determination of 7 to 8 billion barrels of proven reserves is an extremely conservative piece of information. Now, what was troubling at the Senate Resources Committee level is the inconsistency within information that we were receiving, for example, from the Department of Natural Resources or from AOGC regarding reserve information that were about half of the reserves information that was identified in the Gleason decision, but what must be understood is out of the Gleason decision, that was the numbers came from internal oil industry documents. These are what was identified as the best sources of information as compared to information that was, while it may be publicly available, was not the most reliable, the most useful, or the most important information. And that information was obtained only because they exercised the power of subpoena as part of a trial process to get access to the most important documents, and the court relied upon the internal industry documents, which the industry relies upon as to proven reserves and production forecasting. Again, within that decision, I bring up the issue of low flow studies. It is not relevant in the sense of a goal that is to be reached, but is only part of the analysis of the estimated life of the proven reserves. We heard about the internal documents, the JTG study of 2005, which indicates that the pipeline will flow down to 135,000 barrels a day. That is at page 65 of the Brenna. We heard about the Carpenter 2010 study, which indicates the pipeline will flow at less than 100,000 barrels. That's found at page 68 of the Brenna study. Ultimately, the determination of Judge Gleason based upon all of the facts before her, indicated that operation of the TAPS system will be at least through 2065. But to show the conservative nature of that opinion, it's important when one, if one looks at Brenna pages 51 and 52, that in part the internal BP documents that she relied upon in, was based upon BP that said that they, that their estimates were operation through 2075 and 2065. So the judge's determination at 2065 is very conservative, even referencing the other internal documents of, for example, BP. The 7 billion to 8 billion barrels of proven reserves can be found at Brenna page 57. And also at Brenna page 56, there's a graph that addresses that as oil prices increase, the concept of economically recoverable oil also increases, in that there is a direct correlation. For every $10 increase in the price of a barrel of crude, that there is approximately a 5.5-year increase in the economic life of the TAP structure. And there's a graph in there that explicitly shows that correlation and the how that has been established over varying price ranges. Very quickly, as to the access to information, this can be found at Brenna page 94. One of the clear indications that they make is that the subpoena power should be exercised by our Department of Revenue, and that the yes, Mr.
We want to go to the next slide for the audience. Slide 39.
Okay. Thank you. That the subpoena power should be exercised to not rely upon taxpayer volunteers or publicly available information. And again, the dramatic differences between the information that was being volunteered as compared to the most substantive, reliable, and informative information that was included within their internal documentation that had not been volunteered. And ultimately, part of the question that the Senate Finance Committee has to make is whether it is relying upon the best information as compared to the least reliable information. Turning now to the next, and again, that we've just finished some of the lessons that were learned at the Senate Resources Committee. We're now turning back to some basic petroleum economics. There was a course that I kind of refer generally to, a Petroleum Economics 101. And one of the aspects that you come to acknowledge that when you look at this is there are three questions that have to be asked. What will it cost? What is it worth? And will it earn sufficient profit? And I believe that at the we, as a legislator, always get the first question, what it will cost, when one analyzes the operating costs at the Central North Slope, the capital expenditure costs, all of that. We always get the first component. But if you want to put together a fiscal system that is complete and comprehensive, the answers to the next two questions are most important. What is it worth, meaning what is the resource worth, and will the investment provide a sufficient return? And I believe that the Senate Finance Committee is the best committee at investigating those two questions. And as a personal opinion, it's I believe that Alaskans, as the owner of the resources, have the right to know these answers so that they understand moving forward the balance between the state as an owner state and the industry. There are some examples provided on page 42 where one can say, well, it's much cheaper to drill a well in Kansas as compared to drilling a well in Alaska. And again, if you just look at the cost of doing business in Alaska, you can say nobody wants to be here. But the question is what is it worth and what rate of return? You know, the marginal reserve additions from drilling in Alaska are a factor of more than tenfold greater than in Kansas. And so while the drilling costs in Alaska are more expensive, Alaska experiences a greater payoff. And so that is part of not just asking the first question, what does it cost, but what is it worth and what is the rate of return, is an important component. On page 43, again addressing that last question of oil industry profitability, there was a study that was done in 1989, and this was prepared for the Alaska Department of Revenue by a professor out of the University of North Texas to study what profits had been distributed over the period of time 1969 through 1987. And again, I think that these are some pretty startling figures that when this committee goes through this, and one ultimately is part of the establishment of a fiscal tax system in the state of Alaska that is part of the Senate Bill 192, is understanding with similar numbers what the split should be between industry, the federal government, and the state of Alaska. As part of that overall understanding is, will this investment earn a sufficient profit for those that are investing in the document? And again, Mr. Stepp is indicating to me that this document is in their packet, so they have complete access to that. Again, continuing on slide 44, what is important to take away from this slide is returning now to the integrated operation understanding that we began here about an hour ago. We understand that the North Slope operators have integrated operations. In 1989, the study that was concluded recognized that production profits do not just stop, so to speak, at Alaska's boundaries, that the North Slope producers receive profits from Alaska oil outside of Alaska, and it identifies several methodologies by which an integrated operator makes profits on its Alaska oil even beyond the boundaries of Alaska. And so that's the takeaway from slide 44. Slide 45 is just for that period of time, 1969 through 1987. It's just kind of a takeaway number of what on a 24/7, 365 days a year for 10 and a half years, what profits were made in Alaska. Slide 46 is a statement by Lord John Brown, Chief Executive Officer of BP. And this was part of his address in April of 2004. And at that time, what I found interesting about this address to his shareholders was they were talking about high oil prices. And at that time, high oil prices were defined as being above $20 a barrel. And when Lord John Brown was indicating that at high oil prices that they were, you know, that BP wanted to, with respect to the excess free cash flow, pay 100% of that to the shareholders. And again, one of the important takeaways is that at less than a decade ago, $20 was a high price of oil. They were stripping excess cash flow from that and repaying that to the shareholders. And at today's prices, at $100 plus a barrel, it's likely that there is also significant excess free cash flow. The next document was a document that very much troubled some members of the Senate Resources Committee. And this is consistent with that 1998 slide that we presented earlier in the harvest mode analysis arising out of the 1997 plan. And this quote is that Alaska's role in BP's portfolio is to provide a stable production base and cash flow to fuel growth elsewhere in the business while improving margins and returns. And again, this is consistent with Pedro Van Muir's statement of harvest mode to Alaska. I believe that it's also important to understand there should be no emotion with when one reads this, because this is just it's a business decision. It recognizes where one is at in a field's development. It also, going back to the introduction of the differences between Alaska as an owner state and the oil industry, this shows a point at where industry and Alaska's goals may not be aligned. And so I just tying it in with one of the very first presentations. The side note was added here, again, to highlight where Alaska's goal and the industry's goals may not be fully aligned, is that as part of the electrification process of the TAP system, and this is a study from 2004, the intent is to eliminate 285 full-time positions. Again, here, this is just one component of the overall upstream and downstream system where a business doing what businesses appropriately do, look for efficiencies, look for downsizing of costs, and they are intending upon eliminating 285 full-time positions. Again, it's presented to highlight areas where goals of government and goals of industry may not all be fully aligned. And Mr. Stepp would like to.
Thank you. And one of the points here is that the committee, the Senate Resources Committee and then this committee, will be presented with a lot of bar graphs. And that kind of descriptive statistic cannot tell a full story. So when the committee sees graphs about unemployment levels on the North Slope, one thing that's not revealed in a bar graph are decisions such as this one that are designed to increase business efficiency opportunities. So I think it's important for the committee to understand that a goal on the North Slope and in the industry is to be more efficient. And being more efficient means that there are efforts underway currently and historically to eliminate jobs. And like Senator Pasquin said, that's not necessarily inherently a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a fact. So that when we see those bar graphs that show employment levels, just wanted to make the point that one thing that's not revealed are the number of business efficiency opportunities, as it's called here, that have taken place. And I don't, there's no way of knowing whether there's been 285 total jobs eliminated due to these efficiencies or a couple of thousand. But it is a part of the bigger picture that needs to be considered and understood.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slide 48 is presented in order to give a little perspective to the committee. And, we addressed early the Department of Revenue reports of 2010 and 2011. Neither of those reports explicitly say that ACES is broken, but I think it's also important to know that the senior policy advisor to Governor Parnell in August 2010 is addressing the issue of the strong profits under the ACES system, and where ConocoPhillips is identifying that Alaska's activity accounted for 12% of its worldwide production, but 29% of its corporate profits, and that Conoco's exploration and production activities continue to be more profitable in Alaska than across the lower 48. So again, there's nothing indicated by the senior policy advisor to Governor Parnell to indicate that ACES was broken, and that's the purpose of that slide. Slide 49, if one believes that there may be a correlation or a proxy relationship between the Prudhoe Bay the BP Prudhoe Bay Royalty Trust and operation on the Central North Slope and profits. This is just to go through. This is information that's about a month old, month and a half old, talking about the past 10 years in the Royalty Trust earned a total return of 2,248% over the last 10 years. If you'd invested $5,000 in 10 years, it would have grown to $117,400. That's in addition. That rate of return is in addition to its share price increase, which gained 667%. And talking about the BP Royalty Trust from 1990 to that time, earned 5,089%. So just, again, an indication. Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
No, go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, and through the chair. And this is your time to make a presentation, so I don't want to interrupt. But I do want to point out, as we go through this, that the frame of documents that you've put together is based on your perspective and you're laying your foundation, but there are other documents out there. in particular in this one area on page 49, from the very same website, Seeking Alpha, there is an opinion, I'd be happy to distribute it to the committee, there is an opinion by other investors that the BP Trust is actually a short opportunity and overvalued. And they go in to talk specifically about Alaska's progressive tax regime and the fact that when you look at the calculations, people aren't really taking that into account, and that the, as a result, it's overvalued. And I cite that as one example as we go through these documents for the public to understand. We all sit here as one committee, but if each of us were to put together a different packet like this, we might put together different documents in that packet. And I think it's important as we approach this with a critical thought process that there are different viewpoints. And I'll submit it, but one of the quotes in on page 3 of that opinion is, to my knowledge, the ACES progressive tax regime is one of the most penalizing tax regimes in North America. And it's just interesting. So this guy's recommending do not invest at all in this trust because it's overvalued, and it might have been a good deal before ACES, but it certainly isn't now.
Okay, we'll continue. When we get into these websites dealing with some of the traded securities, you can have opinions all over the place. I think the point is that the value of the BP Trust has increased, and I think that was the point, but there is definitely always concern out there that of the valuation, either something being over or undervalued.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. My point is just simply that it's more helpful, I think, when you are going to cite, for example, Seeking Alpha is an interesting website, but if you're going to cite to one opinion, why not cite to a few others? Mm-hmm. I think that gives the committee a broader range of opinions from which mm-hmm. to form their opinions, and I think that's my concern as we move forward. I know you are a good chairman, and I appreciate your thoughts. I'd like to have more opinions, more dialogue, more facts brought into this, not just laying the foundation to prove out one point. Mm-hmm. That's our job here in the Finance Committee, is to come up with what's the right tax regime based on a variety of factors and opinions.
Well, this is just the first publication. We're just
Understood.
Trying to get our presentation. We're trying to get the bill on the table. All that type of stuff will come. And then some of these issues that are brought forward and worked on in the Resources Committee may not surface here at Finance, depending on the interest of the committee members and or the public. For instance, if there's a reasonable conclusion that there's sufficient resources in the Arctic to facilitate the operation of TAPS well beyond the next 15, 20 years, we're not going to go back and revisit that. But if we have other viewpoints put forward that we're in a decade out, we're in an imminent position of reclamation of the Arctic, then we're going to stop the proceedings and deal with those issues, because some of them's flat or of misinformation directly delivered to the public for scare tactics.
Absolutely.
So what we want to do here is concentrate on the financial aspects of what's going on. So there might be issues in the presentation this morning that future presenters might want to drop back and make comments on, and that's fine. We'll give them the time to do that.
I sincerely appreciate your comments, and I just wanted to make those initial comments because this is the first day the public is having an opportunity and the Finance Committee to hear this as well as industry. And I certainly want people out there listening to understand that this is a dialogue, and this committee is built on that foundation, and this is one member of the Senate's perspective, and he's laying his foundation for that perspective. But others of us may choose to use different charts, different graphs, and different information, even from exact websites.
Okay, well, we're going to go on because the information presented here is information that's been presented to the Resources Committee.
Understood.
There are documents that are in the public domain, and were presented at the hearings. So I'm trying to listen to his presentation and recall and make sure that we're staying on track, because we all have, opinions on this subject that vary substantially across the spectrum.
Absolutely.
But clearly this packet this morning is going to be reference a document, for instance. If there's the FAST study, if someone has a question on the FAST study, they'll have a, you know, an easy place to go get it. But anyway, with that, Senator Pascavan, go ahead and continue. Slide 51, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the next section is derived from the question that I submitted to the Department of Revenue in to define the problem as they perceived it to the Senate Resources Committee. And on page 52 is the bullet points that were drafted by the Department of Revenue to define their understanding of the problem. And then beginning at slide 53, again, returning to the publication, the book that we started this presentation with, in Chapter 7, they discuss evaluating fiscal regimes and address the concept of oil development. And they talk here about the unprecedented rise in the price of crude oil, then the sudden fall of crude oil pricing that was consistent with the Great Recession and the collapse of the world economic system. And it identifies then the concentrated attention once again on how petroleum revenues are to be shared between a government and an oil industry operator. And it's just saying that over that spectrum of pricing, you know, much attention was being focused worldwide on the sharing between oil industry and jurisdictions. On page 54, they're again talking about high oil prices. This is a 2010 study presented in Beijing, China, as part of the Society of Petroleum Engineers, talking about fiscal regimes in volatile oil pricing eras and what options exist for balancing the interests of a resource owner and an investor company. And again, it identifies that the challenge in drafting that fiscal policy is to ensure a high share of value is secured by the government. And that is ultimately the overarching goal, recognizing, though, at the same time that the policy must encourage the exploration of these valuable resources and keep it fair for the interests of the oil companies. And again, it's how that equilibrium can be derived, recognizing that the world may be in a period of time of volatile oil pricing. Again, going back to the Department of Revenue defining the problem, they address the issue of the steady decline in TAP's throughput. Again, going back to 1988 in the Department of Revenue Revenue Sources book, it was recognized by the Department of Revenue more than 20 years ago that while they didn't know the exact date that decline would start, they're saying it's going to be either next year or the year after. You know, in other words, this is not a new issue, but it's certainly an important issue. Going into revenue, page 56, the revenue source book, fall 1989, they talk about the Department of Revenue addresses the inevitable decline in the huge Prudhoe Bay field has started sooner than they predicted. It will continue to steadily fall and drop less than half its present level in 10 years. The reason why I included this is the next bullet point is the question is there another Prudhoe Bay up on the central north slope? And they said finding such a supergiant is extremely rare. And so that's all in the concept of what treatment facilities might be constructed, what are the potentials of discovering these multi-billion barrel fields. And while we would all hope for that, the potential for that is extremely rare. Again, the next paragraph talks about Alaska in 1989 was standing on the precipice, talking about budget cuts, more efficient programs, all of the same things. Again, these are important issues, but certainly not new issues to the state of Alaska. My focus, as I advanced earlier, would indicate that the committee should look to the value of Alaska's oil resource and not just look to the rates of decline. When looking at the value of the resource, there is much reason for optimism, even with an understanding of the decline in production, when one looks at value. Slide 57 is a excerpt from a revenue sources book, the Department of Revenue in 1992, again addressing the start of the irreversible decline and the attempts at holding statewide production decline throughout 1995 to less than 9% from 92 to 95. So again, just addressing the engineering issues of a maturing field. In spring of 1994, the slide again pretty clear as far as this issue has been with Alaska for many years. In 1992, in slide 59, there was a presentation by two authors from ARCO titled "With Prudhoe Bay in Decline, What's Next for Alaska?" It is explicitly identified that there is decline and there will be continue to decline. And they identify that for accountants, the decline began in 88, but that to engineers, the decline began long before that. In other words, this is part of I think it's appropriate for this committee to understand that decline issues out of the Central North Slope with the conventional oil resources is an engineering issue more than anything, any other thing. It's an engineering issue. And that here is that the second from the bottom is that adding more wells can't keep the oil production rate up forever. We're past the point where drilling can stave off a falling oil rate. And they conclude with total oil field production when is reached when treatment facility capacities to handle the associated water and gas are reached at the individual treatment facilities.
We're going to stop the presentation this morning. We're out of time. I think what we'll do, though, is pick up at our 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock today, we're scheduled to work on the capital budget, review University of Alaska, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Department of Public Safety's budget. So what we'll do is we'll pick up this presentation and see if we can finish it up, I guess, this afternoon, along with our capital budget work. And if not, we'll at least get through another 45 minutes or so of this presentation and finish it up in the morning, because next up will be Department of Revenue, and they have however much time they need to present what they want to present. So with that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the morning session, reconvene here 1 p.m., meeting adjourned.